some heavily promoted fights, they end up being huge mismatches. Now, I didn't stay up late last night to watch the Mayweather-Pacquiao bout. I couldn't afford it anyway, and if I did, my wife would be so upset with me. You know, I'd be in big trouble. But I hear it ended up fairly one-sided. But both fighters, they did okay. I mean, they're expected to make a pretty good take from that bout. Well over $100 million. Maybe, I think, 60% of the purse goes to Mayweather, and Pacquiao collects the other 40%. Not bad for, you know, a couple hours' work, whatever it was. Now, the seats, you know, if you wanted to attend, I guess it was an arena there that seated 16,500, something like that. If you looked at some of the bids as to what the seats were going for earlier, they didn't make the seats available, I guess, to the public until later on, but they were priced, you know, as high as 7,500 and the cheapest going for 1,500. But then if you looked at the secondary level pricing, where you could, you know, those tickets got scarfed up. So you look at the scalping or what you really have to pay through StubHub and some of those places. I mean, they were listed for, you know, as high as 128,000. I don't know that they got anything close to that, and as low as like $6,000. But I mean, it was big bucks, you know, for that fight. That was a pretty big deal. In the boxing world, anyway, last night's fight. Well, what we looked at in Chapter 46, this is quite a significant contest here, but this is no contest that we look at here. When you look at the contest between the one true God and the false gods, the idols of Babylon, it's a walkover, you know, it's a lay down, it's a no moss type of confrontation here when God enters into conflict with the false gods of Babylon. Talk about an undefeated record. That's what God has. Nobody can stand up against God. Nobody can compare themselves to the one true God, the God of Israel. That's the message that Isaiah has been trumpeting throughout this entire book as he's preparing God's people so that they would be able to withstand the pressure that lies ahead of them as they go off into the Babylonian captivity, as they're faced with extreme religious pressure, the temptation to deviate from faith in the one true God, to be corrupted, to be tainted by this pressure of idolatry and these Babylonian gods. Isaiah is trying to prepare them so that they would stand firm and they would be able to maintain their faith under that type of pressure when they are in bondage in Babylon. They need assurance that their God is able to judge their enemies and is able to provide deliverance and salvation and ultimately deliver them. For ourselves, where do you look for relief from the burdens of this life? Where do you find your fulfillment, your meaning in life? What dictates your value system? What gets you up and going in the morning so that you have an agenda, something that you want to accomplish, that you want to give your energy and your passion and your life towards? What is it that determines what you're pursuing with your time and with your talents? When times get rocky, where is your anchor? Where do you turn to for a solid foundation, for hope in the midst of crisis? False religions, the allure of idolatry, they make a lot of promises. They tend to offer, we can provide health and prosperity, we can provide happiness, and we can provide ultimate bliss in the hereafter. And yet, these are only idle and empty and false promises that will bring people to despair and that will cause great frustration. The message that Isaiah has here in chapter 46, only the true God can carry his people and deliver on the promise of salvation. There's a lot of religions making a lot of promises, but God says he's the only one that can deliver. Because he's sovereign, because he controls all things, he's able to deliver on his promises and ultimately his promise of salvation. So we have a very simple outline. This passage is organized very simply for us. The first four verses, there's a fundamental contrast that is given. We're going to look at who carries whom in the first four verses. And then in verses 5 to 7, there's this futile comparison. Let's look at God stacked up against the false gods. And let's see, it's not even a comparison that's worth making. Then God goes on to give assurances to his people. In verses 8 to 11, he sets forth his sovereign purpose, why it is that we should trust in his claim that he can bear our load, that he can deliver his people and provide salvation. And then he concludes in verses 12 to 13 with a tremendous gospel portion as he sets forth his salvation promise. And as he says that his salvation is quite near, and he's going to bring it about, and he's going to focus it around the people there in Jerusalem and yet offer it to all the world. So we'll begin in verses 1 to 4, this fundamental contrast. Who carries whom? The contrast between these false gods of Babylon that create burdens for others. In fact, they burden down the beasts that have to lug them about. So these false gods are a burden. They're not relieving the burden of anybody. They're a burden themselves. And that is contrasted between the burden-bearing true God of Israel. Verse 1, Bel has bowed down. Nebo stoops over, the two main gods there in Babylon. Their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. What a tiresome verse. One verse and it just wears you out. It only takes one verse, you're exhausted by the time you read that first verse. As you think of, here are the ones in whom Babylon is making their boast. These are the two chief gods, Bel, meaning Lord, and Nebo, meaning protect the boundary. These prefixes are seen at the front of the names of kings. You know, King Nebuchadnezzar, Neb, that prefix in front of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, you know, Bel with the prefix there. So you have these gods honored in the naming of the leaders in this nation here. It's interesting that Nebo, apparently he was the god of writing. So us English majors should pay special attention to this idol Nebo. He was the god of the intellectuals, the academics. He was the god of divine interpretation. He was the god who was the god of learning, writing, astronomy. But both of these gods, they had images, and apparently they were big, impressive images that they had created to worship and to bow down to. And they had this annual New Year's Day festival where they would load these idols up, I guess, on carts and bring them out to whatever the procession was. And they would have their big parades and their big celebrations. And these gods would be there and having been taken from their temple, which is their normal habitation, where they're set in place, immovable, there where you can go and visit them in their temples. Here they're paraded about, and these beasts of burden are ones who would lug them about there. But the imagery that Isaiah provides here is not an imagery of majesty, of ones who would be reigning supreme, ones who would be Lord over all. Here you have an image of these idols who are stooped over, who are slouching, who themselves have admitted defeat. It's a defeated posture that you see these idols in. And so you see that they're humiliated, they're ashamed. In fact, they themselves, in verse 2, not only could they not deliver anybody, they couldn't rescue anybody, but they themselves have gone into captivity. So it's just saying that these gods, what a sad thing it is that they have burdened down their people. They're looked to as ones who would be, when we're in dangerous situations, we need deliverance. So we'd call out to them, we'd pray to them, but not only can they not deliver, they actually are just weighing people down with whatever the requirements are of their religion, with whatever it is in terms of having to bear them about. So even the beasts of burden, are burdened down with lugging these around. In contrast, in verses 3 to 4, we see that the true God of Israel, he presents himself as one who actually does bear the burdens of his people. And so he is able to, in a sarcastic sense, in an ironic sense, he's able to make fun of these false gods and say those that have been nothing but burdensome bits of wood and metal. He says in verse 3, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. God's people need to pay attention to what God has to say. He says here that I present a consistent track record as the burden bearer. You can track my history, my performance, and you can see that consistently I have been the one who has carried you. And you should be able to testify to my faithfulness in that. So he says, you people, my people, you're identified there in verses 3 and 4, you're identified as ones who have been born by me from your birth. You've been carried by me from the womb. So God did not come to the party late. You know, these idols, they didn't even exist from the beginning. They had to be created and made by men who were already in their mature years and who would provide the materials to the craftsman who would make it. God says, I didn't have to wait around. I didn't come into existence sort of late in the day. I didn't come late to this deal. I was there when you were in the womb. I was carrying you before you were even born, before you even entered into and took your first steps. It says, I was there before you entered your first breath outside the womb. I was there from your birth. He says, I have consistently borne you and carried you so that there's no way that you shouldn't give allegiance to me. Oswald, he says there's at least three different images that are involved in these verses. One is a father carrying a child. Deuteronomy chapter 1, I'm going to just read a verse here, flip around a couple places. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 31. God says, in the wilderness, you saw how the Lord your God carried you, just as a man carries his son, in all the way which you have walked until you came to this place. So he goes back and refers to their wilderness wanderings and gives an image of a father carrying a son and says, isn't it precious how I took care of you in that way and bore you up and carried you in those difficult times. Of course, we've already seen in Isaiah, if we just flip back to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 11, we've seen the image of a shepherd. A couple times we've seen this imagery. It says, like a shepherd, verse 11, he will tend his flock. In his arm he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. So God has presented himself as the one who acts as a father, the one who acts as a shepherd, and very tenderly and with compassion in order to help those who are hurt and those who need help, God is able to provide that type of assistance and bear you up and carry you like a shepherd. And then he goes on in other passages and speaks of how an eagle carries its eaglets, and you have this sense of soaring and this majestic sense in which God carries this victorious picture. Back in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4, in Exodus 19, verse 4, it says, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. What an amazing thing when you look back at how I judged your enemies and how I rescued you and lifted you up when you were stuck with nothing but the Red Sea in front of you and the Egyptians pursuing behind you. And yet I took care of those Egyptians and I raised you up and carried you like an eagle would. And then a reference in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32, 11. Like an eagle. Well, let's see. I'm gonna start back in verse 9. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, he spread his wings and caught them. He carried them on his pinions. The Lord alone guided him, and there was no foreign god with him. And it goes on and just talks about how the Lord cares and lifts up his people. So we need to ask ourselves whether we really have the conviction and the confidence that this is how God is caring for us every day, that he is with us, that we are in his presence, and that we are lifted up and carried and protected in the same way that a father would care for his child, that a shepherd would care for his sheep, that an eagle would care for its young. One person that I got a lot of good ideas from this message, Brian Boardman, who I've mentioned in the past, he talked about these same images, and then he gave an example from a poem that probably most Christians are familiar with, a poem called Footprints. And you've seen it pictured, you know, many paintings where you have the picture there in the sand of two sets of footprints, and then it dwindles down and you have one set of footprints. And the question is, what happened when there was only, you know, I thought God was with me, and I thought God was walking with me along the whole way. And did God abandon me? Did God leave me on my own so that I was vulnerable? And no. God says, what happened where you see only that one track of footprints? That's when I lifted up and carried you in the difficult times. Amen. And Boardman makes the point. He says, well, really, that's not even accurate. Really, that picture should contain only one set of footprints all the way along. God carries us all the way. God says from the womb, from the birth, and then he goes on and says, even to your old age, I shall be the same. Even to your graying years, I shall bear you. God says, I break out of the mold of what the natural processes are, because our understanding of how things should work is, yes, a father and a mother, they take responsibility for their newborn, for their infants. We carry them until they're too heavy and we can't keep carrying them. They're able to walk and we sort of nurture them on the pathway of independence and we see that transition take place. But when we get old, we think of our parents now. Well, our parents, you know, our moms that are still alive, they're dependent on us. They're now in the tottering stage where they're not so stable. When you look at how they walk along, they're frail. They're not supporting us. They're not carrying us. Our parents are not in that position. That's just how it is with the progression from youth through to old age and maturity. Now the children need to step up and take the responsibility. They need to bear the burdens, and they need to provide support for those aging parents. God says, it's not like that with me. He says, I never change. I never age. I never deteriorate in my ability to provide for your needs and to care for you. Just as it was from the very beginning, my performance remains the same and consistent all throughout your life so that I carry you even to your graying years. I shall bear you. So he goes on and he says, When it's with respect to God, he says, you know, it's not like those advertising caveats where you have some great claim that the investment firm makes and it says, you can have such success. And then the little fine print says there, you know, well, past performance is no guarantee of future results. Uh-oh. Well, then why are you telling me all this? You know, what really is the benefit? God says, no, that's not how it is with God. Past performance is a great testimony and guarantee of future results. He says, past performance is an accurate indicator of future results. I have done it, and I shall carry you, and I shall bury you, and I shall deliver you. Look at how God uses that personal pronoun in these verses here. He uses it five times. In the English, I think there are six of them, but one of them isn't in the Hebrew, apparently. The last one, I shall deliver you, it's just the verb form. It's not the personal pronoun that's used. But by emphasis in the Hebrew, this personal pronoun, he hammers away, I'm going to do it. I've already done it. I'm going to do it again. I'm doing it now. I'll do it forever. And God just goes on and he makes that claim that says, this is an absolute guarantee that I'm providing because I'm immutable, because there's nothing that can thwart my purposes. He says, you can have utmost confidence in what I'm doing here, so that when it comes to these false idols who were a burden, that's not how it is with respect to God. Remember the mantra that Jesus gave when he came. He says that he did not come to be ministered unto, but he came to minister and to give his life a ransom. Mark chapter 10, verse 45. Turn over to Acts chapter 20. I want you to look at this, the same testimony of the Apostle Paul as he speaks of what the model is that he's providing for Christian leaders as he's training up the elders there in Ephesus and preparing to lead them in Acts 20, starting in verse 33. He wants to point to his own personal testimony as one who has been a leader who relieves the burdens of others. He says, I'm not one who made myself a burden. I didn't come as a spiritual leader and suck off of all you people and fleece the sheep. He said, that wasn't the perspective that I had. I came as one who laid down my life sacrificially and ministered to you as the example of the great shepherd was, who came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. Paul says that was my example as well. And this isn't something just for the first century church. God says, I want this example to be perpetuated down through the leadership of the church. And our Christian church has made such a failing at this particular area, and in so many respects has become all about money, all about your own kingdom, all about serving yourself, all about gaining a following for yourself. And yet Paul, he gives a completely different example as he gives the example of Christ, which, you know, people today might say, oh, it's impossible. But Paul didn't say it was impossible. And look at all the responsibility and all the agenda that was laid before him to accomplish. He said, beginning in verse 30. Well, let's start in verse. It's hard to miss any of this. You know, let's start in verse 32. And now I commend you to God and to the word of his grace. So these are his final thoughts to the Ephesian elders, which is able to build you up, to give you the inheritance among all those who are sanctified. And here's my testimony. I have coveted no one's silver or gold or clothes. Well, how do we know that's true? You yourselves know that these hands ministered to my own needs. Not only that, he didn't just take care of himself. He says, I took care also of the men who were with me. In everything, I showed you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. You see, that's the contrast between those who would be burdensome, and like the idols, the false gods of Babylon, versus those who would come to relieve burdens and point people to put their trust and dependence in the God who bears us and carries us all along day by day by day. Carrie and I had an interesting interaction this week. We had someone come over to the home. We're looking at a home improvement project, and I don't want to say anything too specifically, but I had a good conversation with this individual, and he actually comes from a mega church in the area that we'd be familiar with, and he wasn't saying anything in any disparaging way. He's very, very loyal to his church, and yet as we talked, it was with sadness that he relayed some things that I found very troubling about his church experience. His view of the highest echelon of leaders in his church is, number one, they're overpaid. They've created salaries and perks and things for themselves that are burdensome upon the congregation in some sense. There's so much money flowing through the place, he says, it's just amazing. But they're overpaid, and he says, and I really, honestly, I don't think they work that hard. I look at their workload, and I look at how hard I work every day, and then what I do for the church and the Lord, and how I have to give up my evenings and my whatever. He says, I look at what I'm doing, and I look at what they're doing, and it looks like an easy life to me. It doesn't look, you know, it doesn't look like something that would be this model that the Apostle Paul was given. So I think it's very important, you know, in this day and age to look at a passage like we're in Isaiah chapter 46 and see this contrast that the Lord is providing. This is a fundamental contrast that should be true among spiritual leaders, that is true of God versus false gods, is God is the one who ministers. God is the one who bears burdens, and these false gods are just a wearisome burden to others. But Isaiah goes on, and he draws this out even further as he gets to the point of comparison. He goes from the contrast that he's offered, and now he says, well, let's try and make a comparison, but actually you can't make a comparison. It's a futile comparison, because God stands alone. There is no way that you can compare God to anyone. The unique glory of the true God is revealed as we begin in verse 5. To whom would you liken me? This is God talking. To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we should be alike? God always, he calls these false gods into the arena and throws down the gauntlet and the challenge and says to them, make your best case, and says, well, let's have a comparison. Shut up, there is no comparison. It's over before it starts. God says he is unique. He stands alone in terms of his glory. Back to the analogy of the fight scene, you know, before all of these big fights, they have the weigh-in scene, which is a big trumped-up promotional thing where they sort of can eyeball each other, and you can, you know, they strip you down to your shorts, and they pop you on the scales there, and they get all the measurables so that you can compare, you know, opponent A versus opponent B. What are we looking at in terms of height, of weight, you know, the length in terms of their wingspan or whatever it is that they their reach that they have, whatever it is. And they do it in the NFL scouting combine when they bring all the drafts there and they get all the measurables, if you watch the draft like I do. We won't go into the draft. Anyway, so God says, hey, if you want to get these measurables, says there's nothing. You try and put us on a scale, there's no scale you can find. There's nothing to even compare. It's futile to make any comparison. He says in verses 6 to 7, let's look at the unproductive glitter of the false gods. He says, those who lavish gold from the purse, They weigh silver on the scale. They hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. So he's going into the process of how does this god come into existence? You know, let's track back and look at the origin of this god. We take our own gold and silver that we've worked hard for, okay? We have to take that. The god doesn't come up and produce this gold and silver himself and say, look what I bring to the table, you know? I've got this to offer to you. He's got nothing to offer. He doesn't even exist. We make him, and we're not even able to make him. We've got to give this to some master craftsman who then is able to shape it and mold it into some type of a god. But then, ironically, it says, they bow down. Indeed, they worship it. How can that be? I mean, how does that make any sense? E.J. Young, he says, when the work is completed and the dead gold that came from mines under the ground is made into a god, the worshipers engage in the act of supreme folly in that they bow down to what has just been created at their own expense. This is the fourth time that the making of idols is described. Back in Isaiah, you could look at chapter 40, verse 19, chapter 41, verse 7, chapter 44, verse 9 and following. We see many instances where Isaiah goes back to this same theme of how the idols were created and therefore what the folly is, that it might glitter at the end. The end result might look impressive, and you might on your New Day's festival, you know, plop it out there and say, wow, look at this. But look behind the curtain, and it's really, you know, all that glitters isn't gold, and it's, you know, it's unproductive. He says, look at the lack of mobility of this idol. It says they have to lift it upon the shoulder and carry it. It can't even move from point A to point B. It can't get to some other place. You know, God is everywhere. God is ever present. How do you contrast, you know, compare God? It's a futile comparison with a God who's everywhere with the idol that can't even move from point A to B. In fact, the idol's nowhere because it doesn't even exist. They set it in its place, and it stands there. It does not move from its place. And then look at how ineffective. That's the ultimate test that you want to make is, can the God deliver? Can the God help you? When you're in need, does it come through for you? He says it's totally ineffective. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from his distress. So God has put forth this fundamental contrast. He's exposed this futile comparison, and now he wants to give assurance to his people that he really is able to fulfill his promise of carrying his people all the time. He is going to be able to come through in terms of offering judgment and offering salvation. And so he presents in verses 8 to 11 his sovereign purpose, that he goes about and accomplishes his own agenda. He's able to carry his people because he has his own good pleasure that he's working out through all of time. And nobody can thwart his purposes. He starts in verses 8 to the beginning of verse 9. He says, there's a little memory exercise that I'd like you people to indulge in. He says, if you would, he said, remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind. Now, it's interesting how he addresses these people. These are the people of Israel, I think, not so much addressing the foreigners here. I think he's addressing his own people of Israel that he's trying to give assurance to, and yet he addresses them. He says, you transgressors. You know, that'd be a great way for me to open up the message. You know, just come in this morning and say, well, you transgressors! I'm glad you showed up this morning, you transgressors! You rebels over there! It's good to see you! You know? That would be a little, you know, maybe that would get just keep you awake for a few more minutes. But God's not bashful. He's not out to try and just flatter people and just, you know, honey sugarcoat things. He just calls it like it is. He says, you're never going to come to the place where I can help you unless you come to the place where you confess what your need really is, that you really stand before me as lawbreakers. You stand before me as ones who have been in rebellion, ones who cannot on your own change your spots and save yourselves. So you stand as transgressors, and because of that, there's a memory exercise here that's important for you to perform. You need to remember the former things that are long past. The things that God has done in the past, he didn't do them so that they would just be gone and forgotten. He says, what I have done should have value in the present if you would just bring it to mind and draw the lessons out of it. Just as the New Testament talks about pointing back to the Old Testament, these things were written for our instruction. They're written so that we'd go back in our memory and we would have something that we could learn from, and we wouldn't repeat the mistakes of the past, and we would gain confidence and assurance. So his goal here is to encourage and provide assurance to undergird the faith of his people in his promise to be able to save and deliver and carry and bear his people. It's interesting that God wants people to use their minds. You know, God doesn't want people to be mindless, you know, take leap of faith in the dark, you know, type of people. God is not one who's all stirred up by emotion. You know, he's not out trying to manipulate us into feeling good about something, working us up into a frenzy so that somehow he guides us down some path where we're not rationally thinking about it. We're just driven by emotion. Look at the flim-flam TV spiritual leaders that you see, whether they call themselves evangelists or prophets or apostles, whatever they call themselves on TV. It's all about emotion. There's very little content in what they have to say. There's very little appeal to your thinking, to your intellect. If you look at the message they put out there, it's very shallow, but emotion, very high level of emotion. You've got the setting, you know, you've got the stage, and the set is beautiful. I mean, it's just, it's inspiring. You know, you've got the music, and it might even have been better than our performance this morning. I mean, the music is sensational, you know? It's just otherworldly. And so they're masters at manipulation of people's emotions. And that's how they try to gain the advantage. And God says he doesn't work that way. He addresses his presentation to the mind. He wants our minds to be engaged. So he wants us to look back at all these monuments. I've talked before, I really need to get to this sermon series where I want to go back and I look at all the monuments that God instructed his people to create through the Old Testament. Because it's beautiful. All the times that God says, set up these stones here. Set up this monument here. And remember, from now on into the future, remember what I did for you here. So that you learn the lesson and you don't forget it. Oswalt, another commentator, he says, God is not to be known in the endlessly recurring cycles of nature, mind-numbing in their glorious repetitions, but in his stark, unrepeatable intrusions into history. Remember those moments, say Moses and all the prophets, for as you do, you will see reality. You will see God as he really is and know that you can entrust yourself to him. Look at when God has intervened in the history of his people. Look at what God has accomplished and hang on to those moments as anchors and get strength from those moments. So there's this memory exercise that God exhorts his people to undergo. And then verses 9b to 11 here is really a repetition of the same themes that we have seen in the last chapters of Isaiah. He basically talks about, first of all, declaring his uniqueness and then demonstrating his uniqueness. And again, he alternates between he's going to declare that he's the unique and only God, and then he's going to demonstrate that he's the unique and only God. And here it's related to his sovereign purpose. That his uniqueness, because he alone is God, he's able to accomplish his agenda. He can set forth his purposes, and he can work them out in a sovereign fashion. He can do that for all things, not just for some major things. He can do it for all the details of the world and of our lives and of history. And he can do it for all time, not just for some portion of time. And he can do it in a way that has meaning because it's working out his purposes. So he goes and he declares his uniqueness, for I am God and there is no other. I am God, there's no one like me. We've heard that before. He demonstrates his uniqueness. He gives a general demonstration, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things which have not been. In other words, this whole predictive idea of prophecy is an amazing thing that God can predict the future. Now, some people, their view of sovereignty, their view even of these predictive prophecies is, well, God can see all things. God knows all things. Therefore, God can look into the future. Therefore, he can see what will happen. And therefore, that's how God can say that he sees the end from the beginning. But that's not the sense. That's not the sense in which God says that he is sovereign. God says he goes way beyond that because he controls all things. He sets out the plan. It's his plan. It's not somebody else's plan. He says it's my plan and I work it out. So I'm the initiator. I'm the one that makes it happen. So he's sovereign in a sense that goes way beyond what a lot of evangelicals would think about the sovereignty of God. It's not just that he sees, you know, that's how some people view the doctrine of election and predestination. They say, oh, well, God just looks ahead and he sees who's going to exercise their free will and who's going to make that choice. It all depends on the person's choice. He pulls the switch one way or the other, and it depends on him. God can see what's going to happen, and so he's predestined. That's what predestination means. He sort of saw ahead of time. He has foreknowledge. He knew ahead of time. Well, so that's not foreknowledge in the scriptural view. God determines what's going to happen. He makes the choice. It's his choice that is what matters. And so he gives his definition of sovereign purpose for God. He says, my purpose will be established. I will accomplish all my good pleasure. That's what God means about sovereignty. That's the definition that is biblical when it comes to God's sovereignty. And we could go back and Brian Borgman, he did a good job tracing through the book of Exodus, and I won't take the time to do that this morning. But you could go back and trace through the book of Exodus all the statements where God does something, and then God explains why he did it. He said, I did it in order that the Pharaoh and the Egyptians would know that I'm the only God, that I'm the true God, that I would make my name known. I want you to know that I'm the God and there's no other. And so time after time throughout the book of Exodus, as God is delivering these plagues and these judgments, he's saying, I'm doing it in order that my name would be glorified and magnified, and I put myself out there as the one who's able to accomplish my purposes. Now, remember the magicians, they tried to imitate, you know, what they could, and for a while they said, I think we can keep up, you know, I can do this one, and Moses would do something as God's servant, and the magicians would try to do it. But eventually, as you track through, they had to throw their hands up, and they had to testify, this is the finger of God. Nobody else can do this. I can't do this. I can't fake it anymore. It's obviously the uniqueness of God and his sovereignty as he's working things out. But God doesn't just give general demonstration of his ability to carry out his purposes. He gives a very specific demonstration. He says, he's calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country, whom he's already identified by name as Cyrus, as the one who comes from this eastern empire of Persia, and the one who's going to conquer the Babylonians, and the one who's going to be the instrument that God uses to bring his people back to the promised land. And so he says, there's something very specific that you can, you know, hang your hat on when God says, hey, this is the way that I demonstrate to all of you my sovereign purpose, that I accomplish my agenda and nobody thwarts my purposes. So then he guarantees it at the end. Verse 11, he just gives you this guarantee. He says, truly, I have spoken. Truly, I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. Surely, I will do it. You can't be more definitive. You can't be clearer than that as to what God says about his sovereignty. It's such an important doctrine that if we want to live a peaceful life, you know, that's how you can evaluate your own spiritual maturity. You can look at yourself and say, to what degree am I anxious? Am I fearful? Am I not peaceful in my life? Well, to that degree, I haven't really embraced God's sovereignty. You know, well, you have some tense meeting coming up tomorrow night. Well, you know, who's sovereign in that situation? Am I anxious? Am I troubled? Does it bother me? Does it unsettle me? That's how I, you know, that's how we can look at ourselves and say, Lord, increase our faith that we would live lives where our peace and our joy isn't ruffled by these circumstances around us, because we know that you control even the circumstances, and it's all under your control. You're our Father, you're our Shepherd, you're our eagle that's lifting us up and bearing us and carrying us through all of this. So God goes on in verses 12 to 13. He finishes up here and he makes this tremendous gospel statement, this salvation promise, as he magnifies his grace. You see, the distinction between false religions, they're built around works, system of works, system of you've got to produce something, you've got to do X, Y, and Z. God says, by contrast, it's all of his grace. You've got to come to the point where you acknowledge that you can't do it, where you're bankrupt of your own resources, where you're helpless. And you come and you realize that God wants to make his strength magnified in our weakness. And he wants us to lay a hold of his grace and all that it can provide. So here is this tremendous salvation promise in these closing verses. He gives a proclamation to the stubborn wicked. He says, listen to me, you stubborn-minded who are far from righteousness. You people are not characterized by righteousness. You're characterized by wickedness. You are so far from being in the state of righteousness. You are hard in your mind and your hearts where you've hardened yourselves, where you're not pliable, you're not listening to my words of instruction, you're not easy to steer and easy to guide, you're stubborn, hard mind, hard-hearted people, you're so slow to get it. He says, but you need to listen because you're far from righteousness and you need to be brought near as the Lord Jesus is going to be provided, as the one who's going to come that we're going to celebrate in the Lord's Supper in just a few minutes, the one who came to establish God's righteousness, to bring God's righteousness near to us so that he would offer it, so that by grace through faith we could have the privilege of God's righteousness applied to us. He says this is the message that we need. So he gives this promise of salvation in verse 13 and says it's centered in Israel, not in Babylon, not in these false gods. He says salvation is near. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I'm going to do this quickly. That's why there's a sense of urgency, and you need to pay attention. You need to be on the alert. He says salvation that I offer, this salvation, it's very narrow. It's centered in Israel. He says, I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. I'm going to be faithful to my covenant promises. Even though it looks as they're in captivity there in Babylon, it looks like their God has deserted them. No, their God is still carrying them. That's not some aberration on God's scope, something that surprises God and caught him off guard. That's part of his agenda. That's part of his sovereign plan, and he is in control of that. And he will grant salvation in Zion, even though it doesn't look like it now. And he will establish his glory for Israel. E.J. Young again, he says, the glorious news those who are far from righteousness need to hear is that God has brought his own righteousness near. What must be noted is the divine action. Man is not commanded to obtain salvation or righteousness or to approach them. Rather, the emphasis falls upon what God has done. Salvation is a gift from him alone. He grants salvation in Zion. 1 Peter chapter 5. Verse 6 and 7, as we apply this to ourselves, 1 Peter 5, 6 and 7, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety or burden, that word, cast all of our burden on the one who wants to bear our burdens. He says, why bear the burdens yourself? That would be foolish. Why turn somewhere else to try and get those burdens relieved and be frustrated when you find that these are like idols that are immovable and they can't respond when you pray to them? He says, turn to me. Cast your burden on him. Why? Because he cares for you. Psalm 68, verse 19. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears our burden, the God who is our salvation. Blessed be the Lord. Let's pray.